Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 11:21 p.m. Excuse me, a.m. And today is April 20th. I'm recording a little earlier today because I'm heading to the airport. I'm bringing my daughter to the April North American Championships for fencing. So I've got to jump on a flight in the middle of the afternoon when the market closes. So I thought we'd kick off with Tesla. It's down about 10%, and this is clear confirmation of resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. So they had their earnings yesterday. Sales aren't really great, and they're cutting prices. Now, there's a good reason why they're cutting prices. It's not simply that they're accepting a lower margin, but also that in order to qualify for the credit that one can receive for buying an electric vehicle, the all-in price has to be less than $80,000. So, if Tesla wants to sell their $15,000 full self-driving software, then they have to ensure that the total price of the car is less than $80,000. So, that's, I think, one of the primary reasons why they're reducing the overhead. But of course, what it is also doing is ensuring that their cars are competitive on a cost basis with more modestly priced vehicles. And in that regard, they're trying to capture market share. Now, this isn't all that different from, say, when Kazatom in Kazakhstan, they decided they are, it was, excuse me, it was the Belarusians who decided that they were going to flood the market with uranium, and then they stopped basically all new mining activity from taking place because prices were so low. And I think that's basically the same kind of thing that Tesla is doing. This is an outright price war. And what they're attempting to do is to drive alternative EV manufacturers out of business. And there's a good chance that they will succeed. And that some of those companies, like Rivian or Lucid or Fisker or a half dozen more, are going to have a very difficult time. Now, CATL today came out with an announcement that they have developed a brand new battery that is twice as energy dense as the Qilin battery that they're just about to put into mass production. Now, they haven't said what's in it, and they haven't said how costly it's going to be to produce. So we can still regard this as a future plan, but the boast that they made 18 months ago about the Qilin battery, well, it sounded far-fetched, and now it is going into mass production, so they do have some credibility. But the share was in negative territory today. Now, it's still holding in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But it does beg the question, why isn't it doing better? Well, I think perhaps they're spending an awful lot of money on manufacturing capacity. And this isn't all that different from what happened with Tesla. When they decided to go off and build their gigafactories, then the share price didn't do much of anything until they'd actually finished building them. Now, when we think about how are Chinese markets doing? Well, there's certainly a lot of enthusiasm in the gambling sector, in hotels, and the luxury goods, and everyone is anticipating that the Chinese consumer is back and that spending is going to ramp higher. Now, the H share index is right here in the region of the 200-day moving average, and it's just about holding on. We need to see an upward dynamic here to confirm support. And just paying attention to, for example, Las Vegas Sands, where the share is resurgent and popping up on the upside in here today. So that's, I think, clear confirmation that investors are betting that Chinese consumers are going to be back and spending, and that's likely to be beneficial for hotels and casinos. Certainly, traffic in Macau has picked up. Then let's think a little bit about India. So I think India's in a rather interesting position. When we think about the trade deficit, this graphic from The Economist was, I think, particularly illuminating. It really does help to highlight where India has got some really significant successes. So it's got a very long-term positive trade flow in terms of services. And then there are also secondary income that's really positive. But then they have a trade balance that has been negative and has become progressively more negative over the course of the last few years. Well, part of that is that India is buying oil and buying more of it because it's at a discount, but it's not showing up in terms of exports and improving the trade balance of the manufactured goods like refined products. Now, oil prices today were down $2 and continuing to pull back from the $90 area. And we had a negative day as well, so far at least, on copper, and that was down 5 cents, so easing back from the 420 area. Now, it's still within this range that's been forming since the beginning of this year, and it's holding support in the region of the $4 area and the 200-day moving average. I think it's particularly relevant to look at copper on a long-term basis, because prices right now are really not all that far away from where they were in 2006. So that's been an exceptionally volatile range. And now the bigger question is, are we going to see a break on the upside? Are we in a new secular bull? Or is this secular bear with a generational-long period of ranging going to persist? Now, I'm posting an interview with Zoltan Pulsar today, and what he's basically saying is that one of the oldest adages in the commodity markets is that it's the cure for high prices is high prices. So, and then giving a number of reasons why that's not going to work on this occasion, because there isn't the same sort of feedback loop into high prices contributing to a massive upswing in mining investment, which then subsequently floods the market with liquidity and we get prices coming back down. And because there hasn't been a big investment boom, then the assumption is that prices can't fall, or that if they do fall, they will not fall as much as they have following the peak in 2008. So, and another reason for thinking about that is, and I've heard this as well from several other investment strategists, thinking about the big swell of new money that's going to be created by government fiat, and that governments are going to pioneer a new infrastructure boom, and that it will bring in capital from the private sector at accommodative terms, and there'll be these wonderful public-private partnerships, and we'll live in this utopian ideal of very high commodity prices and not too much investment in new supply and infrastructure that is going to revitalize moribund economies all over the world. Well, I think there is a possible outcome where that occurs, but relying on governments to do the right thing, it seems to me to be a rather weak investment argument. And then the other issue, of course, is that if we're going to pioneer renewable energy, well, how then are how can we expect to make money? By replacing the existing infrastructure with a less efficient alternative. And now I think this definitely feeds through into the CATL announcement that they think that they have solved the solid state battery conundrum and that they will be able to deliver a much more energy dense battery. Now, if they can deliver a battery that can go 1,000 miles without having to be charged, then that's a really significant event. If and if I think it is akin to an iPhone moment for the battery sector. If they have batteries like that, then it does mean that the promise of electric flight would be much more realizable. So there's obviously a big prize at stake here. And if that were to occur, well, then it's quite likely that we will have a secular bull market in commodities, but it would be driven by productivity growth and a major jump in the productive capacity of the global economy as a result of this key technological innovation. But without that kind of innovation, then we are looking at a less efficient environment overall. So I think it is very, and then of course it's risky pricing in a new bull market when interest rates are this high and when credit is deteriorating. And I think it's particularly relevant that it's the big banks have rebounded and the small banks are really under pressure. But even here, the big banks have not pushed back up into the overhead trading range, and we're in negative territory in here today. So then if I think about India and its trade balance, well, India has the demographics to become a major economic powerhouse, and even small changes in the supply of infrastructure and the ease with which it can export goods and enhance the productive capacity of the manufacturing sector, they could have really strong material impacts on the trade deficit and the outlook overall. But well, I think the adage that's in my head is there's many a slip between the cup and the lip. And the Indian rupee is still hovering here in the region of the 200-day moving average. But there's still a sequence of higher reaction lows for the dollar. And it really does need to strengthen through that moving average to confirm that there is demand returning to the currency. Now, when we think about the UK, I rather think that what's happening in the UK is like an exaggerated version of the economic situation in the USA. Because in the USA, a large number of people have retired, and the number of job openings surged, the number of people available to fill those jobs declined, and that has put upward pressure on wages, and it has been one of the stickier factors in inflation. Well, in the UK, a lot of the people retired, a lot of people left and went home, and then a large number of people are claiming disability and say that they can't work. So there is a dearth of workers that is putting upward pressure on wages. Wage demand growth is also taking into account that inflation is running at 10% for 7 consecutive months. That is all putting pressure on the government, putting pressure on the Bank of England to try and curtail inflation. But perhaps the easier way of doing that would be to encourage more people back into the workforce. So that has been one of the reasons why they've tried to ease up on some of the rules on pensions to attract more highly qualified people and also to provide better childcare. But those are carrots. There is, of course, also the stick. And they haven't tried the stick yet because they want to win the next election. But the stick would be basically to start to withdraw some of the supports from the National Health Service, or to introduce rules about mental health and how much time one can take off work or be eligible for benefits for when one has a new diagnosis. Obviously, that is exceptionally problematic. One thing that I think is especially interesting, and I really did not know how it was going to occur, but I did read a report about 5 years ago to the effect that the healthcare industry was investing heavily in psychiatric drugs because they thought that that was where the next bull market was going to be. And Lo and behold, we've had this massive pandemic, and everyone has been locked up at home, and the rate of mental health issues, particularly among teens, has gone through the roof. And I've seen certainly the impact of that on my daughters, and I think that the percentage of young people that are having mental health issues right now is on a scale that has really never been seen before, or at least outside of a major war effort. Now, the S&P 500 Health Index, though, has been going sideways for the last year and a half. And then the really big performer in during the pandemic, which was Moderna, has completely unwound its bull market, and it is still going downwards. And I think these are rather interesting developments that historically, pharmaceuticals have tended to be very defensive because of the reliability of their cash flows. And then they've also tended to bet on chronic conditions, and mental health is certainly a chronic condition. So there's certainly the potential that the pharmaceutical sector can do better, but those pure plays on creating vaccines are certainly coming under pressure. And in between the two, then you have Pfizer. So it has a foothold in every area of the pharmaceutical sector, but the share price is really trending downwards now, and not least because it was considered to have won the war, or the won the battle in trying to dominate the provision of vaccines for COVID, and then has subsequently not come up with a new winning strategy. So the price has completely unwound the bull market. Now, into this type of environment, we continue to see that gold prices are holding up really quite steady. So this is a fairly orderly consolidation in the region of the previous peaks, and I've been, I think, pleasantly surprised that the size of the pullback to date has been quite modest. That does not mean that we can't have a further consolidation. I'll be willing to buy more in the event that we do get a further consolidation, but so far prices are holding up really quite well. We are approaching the time when the circus around the raising of the USA's debt limit is going to become more problematic. And the dollar index is still under pressure. And this looks like a top formation and a period of right-hand extension. And we can give the benefit of the doubt to the downside as long as it is holding below that 200-day moving average. And that suggests that the outlook for gold is likely to be really quite benign. And I think that's generally going to feed through into a more benign environment for the gold shares as well. But they are really quite overbought in the short term. And the big lesson from the last commodity bull market is do not pay up for commodities. And I think that is going to be equally true on this occasion. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.